The Humana Honor Medicare Advantage Plan gives you $1,860 back each year in your Social Security check. Choose coverage that helps you keep more money in your pocket. Learn more at GetHumana.com. Humana, a more human way to healthcare. The Part B Give Back benefit pays part or all of your Part B premium, and the amount may change based on the amount you pay for Part B. Limitations and restrictions may apply. Humana is a Medicare Advantage HMO and PPO organization with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in any Humana plan depends on contract renewal. At Humana, our Medicare Advantage plans give you coverage and care you can count on, along with guided support to help you feel your best. You could have a plan with a $0 premium or an all-in-one plan that may include medical and prescription coverage, as well as routine dental, vision, and hearing. Learn more at GetHumana.com. Humana, a more human way to healthcare. Humana is a Medicare Advantage HMO and PPO organization with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in any Humana plan depends on contract renewal.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex, and welcome back to On Air. Great to be with you guys, and happy Wednesday. How are you, Dan?
It is another week. I'm so excited this week. How are you doing?
All is good. All is good. Well, here, things have been very busy. And I think always as we go into this last quarter of the year, can't quite believe, we are now in the last quarter of the year, things start ramping up as everyone sees this end of year deadline, whether it's because of Christmas in most markets or because they know that, for example, in places like the Middle East, so many people leave over Christmas. So you've only now got a certain number of weeks to get things done. So definitely feels like the tempo is picking up.
Yeah. You know, now that we're into fall, it's funny because this year, Oscar and I have decided we want to go full out Christmas, because I feel like every year it's like, oh, it's December 15th. Like, quick, play Christmas music, get in the spirit. Now I'm like, we're going to take it slow. So yesterday we were playing Jenga and I put on this YouTube like Christmas music compilation.
No.
Yeah, because
it's
like,
too early.
I mean, you could say that, but I never get in the Christmas spirit. So I'm like, I'm going to enjoy it while we can.
We definitely had a podcast episode last year where I had told you, I'd given you clear instructions as to how to switch off, get Christmassy. You can go back and listen to that. We are not discussing this on the 9th of October. So I highly suggest you move on or find another podcast host.
I'm just, you know, I'm putting this out there that you can celebrate Christmas any time of year. This year I learned that the Filipinos kind of do that, because when I flew Philippine Airlines in April, they were playing Christmas music as boarding music in April.
Well, that's insane. That's insane. That's insane.
Yeah, I love it. But also today, I made the horrible mistake. So I think a lot of people, like I know you do, I do, most people who have a following on Instagram also have like a personal account, either in my case that I haven't used in years, like 7 years, or in the case of some other people that they still use. And I logged into that account for like, and swiped through the feed for the first time in probably at least a year. And every time I do it, I just regret it. Like seeing what all these people from your past life are doing. And you remember like what normal people, non like influencers or public figures use Instagram for. And I just find it so like hard to look at. Don't you?
Why? What do you find hard to look at about, for example, people that you went to school with, I don't know, settling down to have a kid or buying their first house? That's usually, I think, what that kind of
to me
those
it's
kind
like
of posts
the,
are like, no?
To me it's like this facade that people have on Instagram to try to make their lives look so perfect.
Yeah, for sure. But that's not just the normal people. That's like, I mean, Instagram is full of horrendous facades and people
that's true.
Pretending that everything is so perfect and rosy and whatever, and it's like, it's awful.
That's kind of true, but I guess it's like, who do you follow? So the people I follow, generally, at least I don't feel that way. I feel like, okay, this is just actually their life, and it made my vibe the whole day so off, because I was like, this feels so like Keeping Up with the Joneses kind of thing, and everyone's like, look at my amazing perfect life, and that's all they publish. And you're just like, okay, I know there's so many things that, you know,
that's unlike you, because you're quite good with your control of social media and not, you know, doom scrolling or ending up in some kind of rabbit hole of people you used to go to school with or whatever. Yeah. So,
but I only scrolled for like 5 minutes and that was enough. I was like, I'm out of here. Log out of this account. Not going back anytime soon.
And I went back to my... We are not going back, exactly. As they say.
And I went back to my lovely little nonstop Dan account where I was like, oh, what's Alex up to? Okay, he's in the gym. What are my other friends up to? Okay, it's more... But I think it's also because I know like what the people I follow are sharing is just like honest. Can I ask you a question?
I want to know, and I could have saved it for when we do, you know, we're going to do that extended kind of question and answer episode in a couple of weeks because we're due one of those and we've got loads of people writing in. But I want to ask you, does it feel weird that everyone you grew up with, for example, everyone you went to school with, whether it's teachers or fellow pupils or so on, know everything, almost everything that you do because you are a YouTuber. So they only have to type in literally your first name, Dan, and click enter. And you're right there. And they know what you, they know you're in their class. They know you as like the 8-year-old and whatever. Is it weird when you think about how if you bump into them, they know everything or they feel they know everything about you? Of course they don't. They only know what you put out on YouTube. Whereas, you know, you don't know anything about them because they don't do what you do.
Yeah, I mean, I like not to think about that because it's a very disturbing and unnatural thought, right? That you know nothing about what those people are doing in their life, but like it's so easy to look me up and read everything that I put out there, you know? So,
and because you put yourself out there by being, you know, such a pop, and you are such a popular YouTuber and you've got all of these millions and millions of views, then people just think that they do know you and they do know everything that's about you and what you're doing. And that's why you've got, you know, then there's discussion and there's comments and there's forums. And it's like, it's very easy for people to forget that you have editorially controlled what you are sharing in the field of airline reviews and so on. And it doesn't mean that there isn't a whole other area of your life that they just simply, you know nothing about. Or
this is sounding very ominous. It's no Diddy situation here.
No, I don't mean it like that. I just mean in this, you know, it's ballsy. It is ballsy to do what you do. I've always said I admire the fact that you're totally cool with the fact you can hold the phone in front of you on the front camera and walk through an airport and people are looking in the background and you're cool with it. I'd be like, oh.
Yeah. You know, I think the difference almost between being like a YouTuber or a traditional celebrity is that on YouTube, you don't have a manager. Like you are trying to figure out, what do I say? What do I want to convey, kind of thing. So I think there's much more coming straight from me and much more that like obviously isn't curated at all, which with a celebrity, it would be. So it's almost like it is more personal to be a YouTuber or whatever it is. And like, for someone, you know, if you had someone in your class who's now a celebrity, that's very different from being able to go on their Instagram and their YouTube and just like find out exactly what they're doing.
Yeah.
That is weird. And the weirdest thing, which I hate, is sometimes someone I've met who sometimes it's because I've added them on WhatsApp or it's God knows how they're, the next time I see them, which might be like a year later, they're not my friend or anything. And I never, ever tell people I'm a YouTuber. I'm super like secretive about it.
What do you say?
I first meet someone, I say, oh, if someone asks me, I might say sometimes I'll just make something up. Like, oh, I'm a consultant is usually my go-to thing. Or, oh, I'm
I wonder where he got that idea from.
What? I got it from TikTok.
Oh, okay. I thought you're kind of like stealing my job title.
No. But sometimes... if I meet someone again, they'll be like, oh, by the way, you popped up in my Facebook feed or you popped up in my Instagram feed. Or I'll get a DM from someone I met once 6 months later, like, oh my God, this reel popped up from you. And I'm like, what? So now from that one interaction with them, once I show up in their feed somehow, they can learn everything they want to know that's out there. So I don't know.
The algorithm works hard, that's for sure. But yeah, just something I
the algorithm I works of. Hard, but the devil works harder.
Yeah, well, I think the algorithm works harder. What else happened this morning?
Oh, okay. Very direct question. So this
anything
morning,
you'd like to share with the listeners, Dan? Yeah,
with the class, speaking of. Yeah. So this morning, we both got a very exciting invite, obviously, which is we were both excited to get invited to the Emirates A350 first delivery event in Toulouse. And Toulouse is like your second home. So I imagine when you saw it, you were like, okay, great. But there are so many things that, you know, we get these invitations. We're lucky to get invitations like this quite often. Mm. And there are a lot of things that go into deciding, like, should I go to this event? And one of the things is that I can't remember if we've said this on the podcast before, but these events always come so last minute. And I'm just wondering, I always wonder, like, how does anyone who goes not have any plans around those dates? Because sometimes
I used
like,
to wonder that yeah. about the, I used to wonder that especially about the older generation who would also attend.
I'd be people like, who have
how
kids.
How are they able? Yeah, basically, but not even older. People that have got kids, I used to think, how are they able to drop everything? Because if I was just about able to drop everything with no kid at home, no commitment in terms of like, you know, in terms of that, then yeah, that's what I used to wonder. But remember, obviously, you know why that these things come super last minute. And it is because, as you say, we are really lucky enough to regularly be invited to things like aircraft deliveries, the first blah, blah, blah to this airline, to that airline, and so on. And typically how it works is that they don't know the delivery date until all of these different hurdles have been cleared. So until obviously the aircraft is assembled, but then also when the aircraft has completed its first period of test flights, then the customer acceptance flights, which are test flights, but with the customer on board, then any modifications or rework that is required. And only then can they get a confirmed date. Sometimes they don't have that date until 4 days in advance maximum, so they know on Monday that okay, we're delivering it on Friday, so then they send out the invitations on Monday, come to the delivery on Friday, we're going to do an event, and the events team are like on standby and they're ready with what they're going to deliver. They just can't always narrow down on when the exact date is going to be, and that's the nature of new aircraft. So Dan, I've been to many delivery events that were 24 hours notice, not even, like they came at midday, the invitation, and I was on the flight at 7 in the morning, assuming I could. There are many that I've missed. There's tons that I've missed, including to places I would have loved to have gone to. I think I missed Vietnam Airlines A350 delivery, would have loved to have done that. I missed a few that were going to a couple of Chinese customers. I remember making a conscious decision to miss the Aeroflot Russian first A350, which was happening in February 2020. And I missed that because I knew that so many internationals were flying in. I was worried. I was thinking, no, this thing about COVID is, and it was still, you know, before any lockdowns. Well, it was only about 10 days before lockdowns, but I remember thinking, no, I don't know if I want to be mixing on that level with that load of international guests from all different areas of the world, when at that time China was struggling big time. Also, there were reports that it was very much widespread in Russia, so I couldn't understand how they were coming for the delivery. So I remember missing that, and I also remember the Airbus team being quite surprised that I'd said I wasn't going because I was concerned about the situation in relation to what was then just known as a coronavirus. Yeah. And 8 days later, we were all in lockdown for it. So,
but gosh, you could have been one of the last Brits to safely travel to Russia. That would have been so cool.
If I remember correctly, it wasn't a delivery flight. It was just a delivery event in Toulouse. Yeah. I don't think it was a delivery flight to Russia. But of course, things were fine with Russia on the whole at that time. I mean, they were, you know, receiving an Airbus aircraft. They were having a big event. There was no complexity in terms of in the relationship as there is now with the severity of the war and so on, and the way Russia is sanctioned and they've been cut out of the Western agreement.
Exactly. I mean, I always kind of trust you to be the one to go to an event because you know so many people, you end up getting invited to a lot of things. For me, like it's always exciting to get invited, but for example, unfortunately for this one, I already have plans, and that like I have a lot of flexibility in my life, and even I have plans a few weeks in advance, you know. So unfortunately, we have to say no to this. But this summer, was the first airline event I went to in, I mean, at least since pre-COVID, several years, or probably several years before that as well, when we went to Riyadh Air, because that there was a combination of things that, you know, made, first of all, we were both available because we got so much advance notice, but also I know
we did get advance notice and it was typically during a period where both of us would be busy, but not maybe in a work capacity, but maybe in a leisure holiday capacity, because it was at the end of June. So again, there's flexibility with that. I was away already, you were away already. So we were like, okay, how do we coordinate
exactly for that? But so the fact that it was, firstly, you would be there. Secondly, it was in Paris. Third, it was during Paris Fashion Week. All those things were like, okay, this just
feels like something. And the Gallery Lafayette once a year sale.
I know, now I'm like, I've marked my calendar for, actually, we should go in January or February again when they had the sale on summer clothes.
You know, the summer sale is better, seriously, than the January sales. But with the exception of Spain, which has some amazing sales post January 6th. So January 6th, of course, the day of the Three Kings. After that, the sales are pretty immense. But everything in a size small or medium sells out because the demographic.
Yeah, that would be perfect for me. But the benefit of going to a sale in January or February is that then it's summer and fall clothes that are on sale, right? And we're always in warmer climates, you and me. So we need those clothes, not winter clothes on sale.
True. Oh, you remind me. I mean, just this morning, I was staring at my vast hoodie collection because my name is Alex Macharis and I am a hoodieaholic. And I was thinking, shall I start wearing you for the fun of it? Like, because the malls are air conditioned. I mean, I had a moment the other night where I can't remember where I was and it was cold and I was like, oh, it's cold in here. Like, we had to move tables because we were directly under the vent. And I was like, wait a second. Maybe there is an opportunity in this. Maybe I bring out the hoodies.
Yeah. No. So anyway, back to, let's stop talking about sales. No, but with also, like, for me, obviously, I always feel a bit uncomfortable with accepting any invites, which is why I literally have only been to one event in like 6 or 7 years, because I never want to have anything to bias me. So with this Riyadh Air thing, I was just like, you know what, this is such a once in a lifetime thing. I'll just, you know, we'll do it. It will be amazing. But even with Emirates, I'm already a big fan, but I don't want anything where I personally feel like, oh, now I know people that work there, and if I say something bad, then I'll feel bad because I know that they're listening and they'll take it personally. And I've had, like, for example, I had lunch with a friend who works for an airline in New York this summer, and he was like, I take it personally when you say something bad about my airline. And I'm like, you literally have no control over any of these things I'm complaining about.
Yeah.
But even on that level, so it's so hard, because then I'm like, oh my God, can I not say anything bad about this airline now just because they have a friend who works there, you know?
No, come on. We are in the business of honesty and being open. And the very kind of foundations of this podcast is that we speak openly with the listeners about our true and real life experiences and so on. And we know we have a bunch of listeners that join us every week from airlines. They are working at the airlines. They are in senior positions at the airlines. In some cases, they are the top position at the airline. That is not going to determine whether or not, you know, we speak about our real life experiences and what we've encountered.
Exactly. But every time I hear that, I love that part of this, but every time I hear that, I'm just like, no, like, I don't want to know, because I, like, my thing is always to be brutally honest. But of course, like, it's hard when you know someone. So that's why I just always try.
Brutally
honest.
Brutally honest.
Brutally.
Anyway, look, the brutally honest thing is, and also that's kind of, that's your brand. I think I always, when people ask me about doing the podcast with you, sometimes they say, oh, what's he like? You know, because they know you from the videos, but maybe they haven't listened to the podcast yet. And I said, well, listen to the podcast and you'll hear what he's like. And they say, oh, but you must disagree on so much, they think, because I think they think that where you are being super brutally honest about your experiences on YouTube, maybe they think I'm not like that. Mm. I am maybe worse than you, but I'm just not doing it on YouTube. You know? Yeah. Instead, I'm just doing it in WhatsApp to you and to others. But so, and here on the podcast.
This is the thing. I happen to be a flight reviewer very publicly on YouTube, but I know we have so many viewers who understand this, but there's always those people who comment who don't understand because they've maybe never been lucky to fly business class, or they just, I don't know, but they don't understand that once you've sat down in business class and you've paid for it, you have a long list of complaints of things you think could be better, because that's always the case. Because if you've spent that type of money, for most people who aren't bathing in it, you're always going to be like, well, actually this thing was better on this other airline, or this thing was like that. And the amount of texts I get from people who are influencers but happen not to be flight reviewers, or people, you know, in the aviation space who just don't review on YouTube, who are texting me moaning about different things about airlines, like, I can't believe how bad this flight was and this happened. But it's like, I just happen to be the one who has to say it publicly and break the news.
Head up above. Yeah. Yeah, well, that's how he makes money, ladies and gents. So don't feel sorry for him. He's good at what he does, and yeah, it's difficult being the one that has to speak out, but at the same time, it's rewarding, or so I hear. So.
Exactly, my truth about this airline.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Speaking of having to do, you know, when you got to do what you got to do for your job.
Yeah. Yeah.
Air India has been in the news this week because
this is horrible.
Do you want to share their suggestion with the world?
Well, it's being introduced as a quote key policy change, and in a nutshell, Air India crew, of which there are thousands, have been informed that they will be required to share hotel rooms during a layover. So again, to provide you with the context to know how this works in case you are unfamiliar, at the overwhelming majority, if not all, airlines that have layovers — layover is the time at the destination between the flights. So for example, if you're based in London and the crew are operating to Miami, they would have perhaps an overnight in Miami in a hotel that is paid entirely for by the airline. And sometimes it includes different arrangements with food and beverage and so on. And then they would return on the following day's sector back from Miami to London. In those scenarios, crew check into the hotels, typically all together, crew and the flight crew. So together, the cabin and the flight crew. And they will get their room, one room per person. And during their layover, which let's say standard is about 24 hours, they can be as social as they want, you know, as we are as humans, and arrange to go out with the crew and sightsee. They can see their family and relatives who live at the destination. They can completely isolate themselves from the rest of the world and not emerge from the room for 24 hours and catch up on some much needed sleep and binge Netflix and order room service. They can do whatever they want, right? The fact that we have a national carrier that is on this aggressive path to profitability now informing this new update to the crew as a cost-cutting measure, requiring crew of all ages to share, I find that a little unacceptable. In fact, not even a little unacceptable. This is horrible for the staff.
Yeah, it 100% is. And I'm sure it will be overturned very quickly. But something we haven't really spoken about on the podcast is, just sometimes you realize how much money airlines spend on crew hotels. And it's obviously different at different airlines, but especially the US carriers and the European carriers, airlines that have been around for a very long time, basically, they still have these contracts in place where the cabin crew stay at, you know, in the center of big cities hotels that, so for example, I was just in New York. We stayed one night at the Marriott Marquis Times Square, which was a big shudder for me, especially considering it costs $1,000 a night on the dates we were there. And as we're leaving for checkout, in pulls a crew of about 15 cabin crew members from Air France who are staying at this insanely expensive hotel.
In the center of Midtown, in the center of Times Square.
Yeah. And the hotel, not only that, but the hotel was sold out. So I'm thinking,
yeah, that hotel's like a train station.
Yeah, it literally is. So I'm thinking, what rate is Air France paying, even with a discount, for these from this one flight? And Air France has like six flights a day, if not more, from Paris to New York. So if all the crew stay here, they're paying for dozens of hotel rooms that... do you know what type of discounts airlines get at these places?
Well, these are all pre-negotiated, and these are, as you say, big business. These are multi-million dollar contracts that airlines will strike with usually the big hotel groups like Marriott, and before when it was Starwood, that was separate, and IHG and different. But that can also differ and become difficult at airports around the world that don't have those big brands readily available for them, but also, you know, some countries don't have those brands full stop, never mind those airports. So they have to go and negotiate sometimes on a case-by-case basis the best available rate. It's incredibly costly for them, as you can imagine. They're not getting anything less than, for example, $70 a night in some scenarios. And if you think they're applying that for the entire crew every night, including the crew that are operating to cities that are served by multiple frequencies. For example, in some scenarios, there have been airlines, predominantly from the Middle East, that have bought the hotel that they are needing to have the crew spend their layovers in all the time, because I guess that was, in some scenarios, a better investment than just continuing to pay. So it's, you know, yes, it's costly for airlines, but it is just one of those operational costs. And it's not even in the top, for example, the top four or five overheads for an airline. Fuel, salaries, all of that comes way higher than what they are paying for these hotel stays. But is it in the top 10 in some metrics or at some airlines? Yes, in terms of operational overheads. And is that why we're seeing the likes of Air India introduce this this policy and inform the crew about it? Yes, they have said that this is a cost-cutting measure. But let's just think practically about what that means, right? So firstly, it was not mentioned in the policy document, but do we think this means that potentially a man and a woman crew members will be sharing?
I highly doubt that at Air India.
I doubt it too.
Yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong. Some do that out of their own choice. That's their business, right?
That's the real type of room sharing they should be encouraging on layovers.
Well, they don't need to encourage that, already happens. But
yeah, true.
But okay, so let's assume then that the policy is that it's males and females, right? What about the fact that, you know, one bathroom, how are they getting ready?
Yeah.
You know, in there, because it's all very well two double beds in a twin room, but how are they getting ready comfortably in the morning when they know, you know, for example, for the women, most airlines mandate and require quite a bit of a routine in terms of the makeup routine and the hair routine before.
It takes like an hour.
Yeah, the crew that I speak to sometimes when, I've got friends that are crew, and my sister will always ask the girls, like, you know, how long do you have to get ready before the flight and so on? Usually they say 2 hours before pickup time, just so they don't rush.
Yeah.
And it's a 2 hour thing. So, yeah, that does seem crazy to us, but yeah. So there's that. Then there's the fact that, of course, sleeping patterns are totally different from one person to the other, not least crew, one with jet lag, one without, one who just landed that morning, one who didn't, and so on. So that's not great. I mean, it's just not great in any sense. I can't find anything other than the fact that it's cost cutting that actually this can be justified. And even with the cost cutting as an excuse, I just think this is just a step too far.
You know what I think they could or should do instead is they should make it voluntary for the crew, and in the sense that if you choose to share a room, you can choose which layovers you might want to do it on. And then if you do it, you get some additional layover allowance to kind of make up for that, right? Because then it would be a win-win. Crew could potentially, maybe they know a friend will be on that flight, or maybe they meet someone on the flight who they get along with well. They say, hey, how about we share a room? And then they get, you know, whatever X amount of what the hotel night would have cost the airline. So the airline ends up gaining some and the crew. What do you think about that suggestion?
I think it's, you know, I think we call Air India now and we tell them we have a slight solution as per your update. But I think the way that this is being introduced, and as of now, all indications suggest this is happening. As you can imagine, there's been a lot of backlash. The crew are very, very upset. I sent this to about 5 airline CEOs, just, you know, keeping the world closer, keeping everyone up to date. So 5 airline CEOs, I sent them this Air India policy document. 4 of them replied, no, sorry, 3 out of 5 replied the same word. They replied, shit. Okay, that was the reaction from 3 of them. The other 2 replied by voice note. One of them said, oh, this is crazy. There are so many other ways that you can reduce overheads and reduce costs, not floor your staff morale in this way, and in terms of international trips and you know, their new requirements. The 5th one is the only one who said to me, you know, if they are able to introduce this and it goes by kind of unnoticed, without too many dramas in the first few months, he said to me, watch other airlines attempt to follow. Oof. I don't know. I was a bit skeptical, but...
But then you also know that it won't be the airlines in Europe or, you know, no. Australia or no North way. America. No way.
No.
But it's going to be
won't even be the Middle East. Not the Gulf carriers.
Maybe not the big
maybe
ones.
Maybe not the main Gulf carriers, but maybe the smaller ones.
Yeah. Could I mean, be. Definitely more. Every Indian airline will adopt it if it works for Air India and there is an uproar.
And again, define if it works. What? If there's no police report or there's no...
Yeah, I don't know.
You know, I mean, the scenarios of what could go wrong are endless.
And I think part of the problem here is that my suggestion wouldn't work purely because so many airlines have such bad, outdated tech. Like, if they had systems where... They could manage their revenue so much better if everything was welcome to 2024. And for example, someone literally could go in and tick, you know, I will share a room with this person. And I know from stories I've heard from flight attendant friends that there are also so many airlines outside of Europe and the West where airlines will specifically be very difficult or restrictive about accepting people's requests. Like, I request this flight, and then for no reason, they'll put you on something else, or they'll change your flight to a different frequency to that destination, even when you could have been on the original, like, just because they sometimes like to make things difficult or whatever it is. So if everything was just brought digitalized and made so that crew could, you know, easily manage their own schedules to some extent, I think Air India could achieve part of what they want to achieve here without making literally all their cabin crew members upset.
Yeah, that's very true. Very true. Well, speaking of the current period and I guess what we're moving into now in regards to winter and sticking with the airline policies and what the CEOs are telling us over the last few weeks, there is this consensus now. I was in a meeting a week ago. I had a meeting yesterday. There is a common and reoccurring theme here, which is that, quote, winter is coming for the airline industry and demand is projected and forecasted to be particularly weak from the end of this month until around the end of March. So that's, of course, the bulk of the winter period. There are the usual exceptions. There's the brief pit that is directly 3 days before, 3 days after Christmas. There is the Thanksgiving part in November. But other than that, things are set to be a little bleak for airlines in terms of demand. And this has some airlines concerned. Now, this is already being reflected in the GDS around the world. So the global systems that distribute airline ticketing. If you have a look at the schedules of an airline that you fly with, you may notice that those schedules are being reduced, slashed in some cases, as from the end of this month, especially to big destinations, which I think is a little surprising. So, for example, the number of flights that operate to LA over the next 4 or 5 months from the likes of European or Middle Eastern carriers is reducing by over 25%. That's quite a significant decrease to a destination that has year-round demand. Now, the same is true for the big cities, London, Paris, Madrid, Lisbon, even Zurich, Frankfurt. Demand is weak. Demand is weakening over the next few months. On one side, it's not great for the airlines because they've enjoyed a very, very strong continuous demand since COVID. On the other hand, it is an opportunity for anyone that has the flexibility to travel to tap into those lower fares. And those lower fares have definitely arrived. Before we came on, Dan, I was doing a quick Skyscanner and also Expert Flyer search at different routes and seeing that cabins are wide open, selling the lowest of fares on routes that I struggled to fly to buy a ticket on just 2 months ago. So it is funny, the seasonality, I think, is returning. And where, as I say, airlines have been riding this strong, continued wave of strong demand, I think that we will now see a very different picture over the coming months. This is not something that I've heard or had a conversation with just one or two airline CEOs. It's something that has been a common theme. And I said to you, didn't I, after my last chat, I said, okay, we have to discuss this on the podcast because there is opportunity for the consumer there. But on the other hand, it's not great for airline businesses who are thinking about how they will navigate the winter.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I always selfishly think like, okay, this is great because there's going to be more award seats and more opportunities for everyone to have slightly cheaper flights. It is interesting that, remember, we were saying this in the spring and over summer as well, seeing signs of things slowing down. And now when winter comes around, and this is the first winter, at least based on my reading, where there aren't, you know, where it isn't a crisis with energy prices in Europe, for example. At least people are expecting it, if there will be. So it's not as uncertain, but still people are traveling less by the looks of it. So we'll keep an eye on this, see how the situation develops. But
speaking of situations developing, of course, let's quickly touch on what has been another complex week for airspace across the Middle East and the impact that it has had on passengers who are traveling between East and West, specifically between, for example, Australia, Southeast Asia and Europe. The Middle East is a massive transit hub and airspace has been all over the place in terms of closures and restrictions ever since Iran was striking Israel a week ago following the escalations that had happened the week prior to that.
So Middle Eastern airlines, especially for the past few years, have been struggling with increasingly limited options for flights. So last year we saw the closure of Sudan airspace, which is a massive chunk of country. Libya has been closed for a long time, so has Yemen. So if you look at a map and you just take those countries into account, that's a lot to the south. Then up north or northwest, you have Syria, which has been closed, well, not closed, but almost all airlines besides pretty much Middle East airlines out of Lebanon have been avoiding Syrian airspace for a long time. Certain European airlines have been avoiding Iran and Iraq. So they sort of alternate between which one, depending on the airline. And then we've said earlier on the podcast that because of this, Afghanistan has sort of become a new route that a lot of airlines are taking. But based on what I've been reading this week, as airspace has been closing down, I felt like, okay, if so many airlines are flying through Afghan airspace, that's fine. I would feel fine with it, and I did in April, but I read some things that kind of concerned me about Afghan airspace, and there are some people sounding alarms saying that airlines should not be choosing to fly over Afghanistan, but each airline makes their own evaluation, and we see world-class airlines, even Singapore Airlines, British Airways, which is, you know, known for its impeccable safety using Afghan airspace, so that's that part of the region. And then, of course, we have the impact of Iraq and Iran. So it is interesting to see the different choices and different impacts, even between airlines that are so close, like Emirates and Qatar Airways. Because given that Emirates is just slightly more east, you know, on a global scale, it's so seemingly insignificant, but that little bit of distance is giving them the option to fly basically slightly east, and then to the east of Iran, east of Tehran, and then pass over Russia, as they have been doing for a long time, in order to get to Los Angeles and San Francisco, Seattle, all the destinations on the U.S. West Coast. Due to Qatar's location just slightly further west, for whatever reason, they are not using Iranian airspace. So their flights to the U.S. West Coast specifically have been quite impacted by this closure because, yes, they're using Iraqi airspace, which has been a bit more efficient than, I think, for a few days when they were going over Saudi Arabia and Egypt. But it's just, it's so fascinating to me to see how every airline makes these different evaluations, and they can be so wildly different between different airlines. And then you have Turkish Airlines, which to me, perhaps most confusingly of all, is using Iraqi airspace on certain routes where it's fine and saves them, you know, a lot of time because they are one of the airlines most impacted by this. But then on other routes, they're not. And it ends up making the flight constantly delayed. So I would love to know, you know, the story behind that. But it is fascinating to just spend, I could spend hours a day just looking on Flight Radar. Okay, what's going on here? Who is choosing to fly where?
And I think
where?
So many people are, especially now, it's a thing, isn't it? Whenever there's hints of escalations in any conflict globally, you then immediately start seeing the screenshots of even people that have no idea about aviation on Flight Radar, and they say, why is this aircraft here? And you're like, well, that's a black line, so it's not actually
exactly
there. It's estimating there. And, or why did this plane just land in Beirut when it's Israeli? And it's like, well, no, that's GPS spoofing. It's all this context is required, and none of it is there. And it's amazing how these tweets take off and go viral with no context, and you're thinking, wow, this is misinformation in action in front of us. But it's because aviation is pretty complex. Most people don't understand that everything that goes into getting an aircraft from A to B, not least when there's a geopolitical conflict or escalation involved.
Yeah. And I mean, if you're trying to look specifically around Israel, Lebanon, and Jordan, just forget about it. Don't trust almost anything, because most of the data is extremely skewed, and you'll see an aircraft that just took off, but it looks like it just landed. Or you'll see, as you said, aircraft that are supposed to be going to Tel Aviv supposedly diverting to Beirut, which they obviously are not. It can get messy if you're looking, zooming in there specifically. But I don't envy any airlines that are operating in these very challenging environments, especially if they heavily depend on these airspaces to operate smoothly.
And with that, airlines have been making decisions as to how to ultimately evacuate some of their citizens away from these hot spots, such as Lebanon more recently. And we've seen Qantas confirm that a 787 will be positioned all the way from Sydney to Larnaca, Cyprus, where Australians that have been taken out of Lebanon will go to Cyprus, board the aircraft, and fly non-stop from Larnaca in Cyprus back to Australia with Qantas. It is a government flight, so it's the Australian government that is paying. It's free to the passengers. Again, a route that we would never ordinarily see a Dreamliner operate nonstop between Cyprus and Australia. In another development, Qatar Airways is doing the same thing. So it's also struck a deal with the Australian government, and it will be repatriating Australia nationals out of Cyprus. They've come predominantly from Lebanon, out of Cyprus, flying them from Larnaca, brief stopover in Doha, and then Doha to Australia, where the passengers can take a Virgin Australia domestic flight to their final destination, again for free and entirely covered by the Australian government. It is that sign of what can happen when airlines work together with governments in order to help repatriate and get people where they need to be. But also interesting, of course, because Qatar and the Virgin Australia deal was just announced last week, and Qantas coming in, trying to show it is the spirit of Australia, and on this rescue mission, closely followed by its two biggest competitors doing exactly the same, given that they had struck the same deal with the Australian government.
Yeah, Qatar Airways went, I don't think so. You're not doing this alone. But this, there are certain situations like this where you have to imagine there's some av geeks who, out of, you know, the horror of what's going on, also see the bright side as av geeks and just go, whoa, I get to fly direct from Larnaca to Australia on a Qantas 787. And it brings me back to the beginning of the pandemic when there were so many people had to be repatriated. And you had the most interesting routes truly in the world in April and May 2020. Like, if I just go through my screenshots from that time, I have so many flights. I have like Islamabad to Manchester, operated by Qatar Airways, Delhi to London Heathrow, operated by Qatar Airways, Los Angeles to Kuwait, operated by Qatar Airways. All of this is on one day I screenshotted. And then, of course, we had Lufthansa sending A380s to Auckland, New Zealand to repatriate people. So, yeah. Anyway, random note there.
Yeah. Definitely. Should we move into Q&A?
Let's do it. Fabian asks us, this is us, well, it's not, I don't think this guy is Swedish, but very common name in Sweden. Fabian says, I've been following on YouTube for years, and first I wanted to commend you for your videos. That's why I'm writing to you regarding a recent weird flight that I recently had from Bucharest to Zanzibar in business class with Turkish Airlines. Flying between Istanbul and Bucharest, you have the option to fly on their brand new Airbus A350-900. Meanwhile, for the flight from Istanbul to Zanzibar, you get a 737 MAX without lie-flat seats, creating a really weird and poor business class experience. Wow. So he basically asks, why do things like this happen?
Demand, market spend, demographic in terms of the demand in economy or business, and the fact that for many African nations, the premium demand is weaker than the big European cities, for example. So they would rather prioritize sending that bigger, more luxurious aircraft there than to markets that don't have a solid demand. But we did only discuss last week how that pisses off many African nation governments that then, understandably so, introduced legislation to forbid foreign carriers from bringing in their worst aircraft.
Yeah, I mean, it is an unfortunate situation that happens quite a lot. And it's definitely an argument for doing something like Singapore Airlines, where you have lie-flat seats on virtually all your aircraft, which means at least you won't be too disappointed in that sense. But there are so many airlines around the world where these kind of weird situations occur, where you're connecting on a, you know, you fly the first flight on a huge aircraft with lie-flat seats, and then just based on what your connection happens to be, you end up getting a small aircraft. So obviously people can see that when they book. So on Google Flights, for example, if you check there, you see what type of seat type you'll be getting. But yeah, I understand for a lot of people, especially if it's, you know, for example, the type of flight where, let's say they're doing, off the top of my head, Dubai, Doha to Baku or something.
Yeah.
So on the first flight, they end up on a beautiful A350-1000. And then they, even in economy, and then they connect to a 737 MAX that doesn't have in-flight entertainment. And that's like truly such a common situation, but such an understandably frustrating situation for people who aren't av geeks. So they don't, you know what to expect. They've just booked something and then the laws of demand take over.
I have a question here from Sean. He asks, hey, Alex, loving the podcast with Dan. I look forward to it every week. With the recent news of Qatar Airways buying a 25% stake in Virgin Australia, I wondered if you could explain the implications this might have for the Australian air travel market and the expansion of both airlines. How do you think it will impact the consumer and competition in Oz? And under a wet lease with QR lending some of its aircraft to VA, does that mean that VA are able to expand to reach further destinations, including Doha? Sean. So I'll break apart the answer and be as brief as I can. But so the first part where you had asked, what do we think this will mean for the Australian air travel market? I think on one side, the goal is to strengthen Virgin Australia as a as a stronger competitor to the ever dominant Qantas. And Australia over recent months has lost two airlines, making the competition landscape much more Qantas led than ever before. The two airlines they lost were Regional Express, better known as Rex, and Bonza, which sounds like a Dollar Tree store or something like that. But anyway, they lost these two airlines, and therefore we need a strong Virgin Australia, if only to better support the interest of the consumer. Because what happens when you have a market that is ruled by one airline is that they will determine and dictate what you will be paying because they have the monopoly. So on one side, it is definitely set to strengthen the domestic landscape and Virgin Australia's ability to compete with Qantas domestically. On the international side of things, the idea is for Qatar Airways to be able to increase its footprint into Australia. It has less than half what Emirates has in terms of access into the Australian market. And therefore, they're able to do this now in a pretty clever way with Virgin Australia, because these will be Virgin Australia marketed flights. So you will be able to buy a Virgin Australia ticket for the likes of, let's say, Melbourne to Doha to Paris. But that first flight from Melbourne to Doha will be operated entirely by wet lease agreement by Qatar Airways, meaning it's a Qatar Airways flight, right? And Qatar Airways will be profiting a certain percentage of that flight per flight. And that's how these deals make money on both sides. So Virgin Australia gets to return back to its international ways. Qatar Airways benefits from greater access and increased flights into the Australian market, an all-important kangaroo route market. And so both benefit there. So I think that from that side, that's kind of the business thinking behind this. For the consumer, consumers set to benefit in those two ways that I've outlined. And ultimately, this is all about you know, strengthening that commitment to having better competition. And we're seeing this in many markets, not just Australia, when people are stuck with one, maximum two airlines, the prices go up, and it's not in the interest of the consumer.
Very well said. I think you covered most of it there. I have a question here from Siddharth. He says, hi Dan, question for the podcast. I love it. Made me feel at home in my first month of college. Oh my God, that's so sweet. In your Delta One video, you mentioned that no one is responsible for cleaning the lavatories on US carriers. Mm. Why is this, and why does it differ from elsewhere? Well, do we need to say more than the fact that it's a US carrier? I feel like that says it all, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, explain, for example, how this differs in some other parts of the world.
So, well, if we're talking about anything besides the Emirates A380 in first class.
We're talking about anything except that. That is extremely niche.
Exactly. That is the only aircraft in the world that has people specifically on board to clean the lavatories. And that's because of the shower spas. Every other world-class airline, whether it's Singapore Airlines or down to the likes of Virgin Atlantic, makes their cabin crew clean the bathrooms. And I was amazed when I got downgraded on Virgin Atlantic. The cabin crew, they would come up, you know, I was sitting in the first row of economy. They would come along with their little bucket, wearing gloves, and they would be in the bathroom for 5 minutes scrubbing it down. And I came in and it was spotless. It was honestly like we hadn't even boarded the flight. So
yeah,
those types of things, especially in economy, are so appreciated. And I know everyone hates to do it. I would hate to do it, but it makes such a difference for passengers when it's done, especially in economy. So I commend Virgin Atlantic for that. But yeah, in the US, their contracts specifically say that they do not have to clean lavatories, and that applies even in first class on American Airlines. And of course, international business class on all the other airlines, even the star, in my opinion, JetBlue. So it's just different contracts stipulating what the crews should and shouldn't do.
Good answer.
Yeah,
good.
Thank you. So here, let's see what other questions we have. Ben says, hi, Dan, love your podcast. What do you think about the changes coming to the Virgin Atlantic Flying Club? And do you think it is good or bad? Do you think Delta has something to do with it as they own a large share in Virgin Atlantic? Let's talk about this. Have you heard about this, Alex?
No, I haven't actually. Okay. What is this?
So they're basically, Virgin Atlantic has announced that soon you will be able to use your points, quote, for any seat, which to any frequent flyer / points person reads as a massive red flag, because they don't say you'll be able to use them at any seat at the normal price, which is always kind of a disguise for devaluing the program. So I would say until we know exactly what this will look like, we can't really say what, if this is good or bad news and what this entails. I think we have to leave it there for today, but it has been a pleasure to spend this hour with you, Alex, and with all our lovely listeners.
Likewise, and please feel free to send in your questions and scenarios, including a popular Reddit scenario that we have started to receive in DM, and I will encourage for more. People are wondering, quote, am I the asshole in XYZ scenarios? So we think we are definitely the ones to tell you whether you are or not, and therefore we encourage you to come in. A few of them are about seat assignments, about babies on board, about one, you know, the husband accepting the upgrade and the wife not, and so on. We are definitely in the business of giving our two pence on that. So feel free to come to slide into our DMs with such scenarios. But I think, yeah, we'll catch up next week. Thank you for listening as always. And Dan, thanks for being here.
Of course. And we will see you all next week on air. Bye-bye.
See you later.
At Humana, our Medicare Advantage plans give you coverage and care you can count on, along with guided support to help you feel your best. You could have a plan with a $0 premium or an all-in-one plan that may include medical and prescription coverage, as well as routine dental, vision, and hearing. Learn more at gethumana.com. Humana, a more human way to healthcare. Humana is a Medicare Advantage HMO and PPO organization with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in any Humana plan depends on contract renewal.